Well, we've made it to another Friday. Thank goodness. Thank goodness it's Friday. It used to be one of my favorite restaurants, TGIF. Do they still exist? I don't know if there's one in the Tri-Cities or not. I think there's one in Pigeon Forge. I think I remember going to not too long ago. But anyway, that has nothing to do with anything other than the fact that I was supposed to be camping today. Yesterday, I had my camper all ready to go, and that thunderstorm hit, and my wife and I were looking at each other thinking, maybe not this weekend. And then it's supposed to get cold, and I think there's a 60% chance of rain today, so we're just going to cool our jets when it comes to camping. I did get my new smart TV installed in my camper. Doesn't that seem like something that shouldn't be in a camper, a television? Aren't you supposed to be getting away from television and all of the technology stuff? You know, when you go camping, you know, tents like we used to, tents and Coleman stoves and Coleman coolers. And I think my dad bought pretty much everything from Coleman. We had to lobby, though, to get him to buy cots to sleep on so he didn't have to sleep on the ground. We won that argument when my mom came camping with us. She says, I'm uncomfortable. You know, let's get some, we need some cots to get off the ground. And plus, I'm scared of snakes and spiders. So she won. She was on our side. But another thing that we can feel comfortable with, at least happy about, is that occasionally government and industry work together. You know, if there's a partnership between government and industry, great things can happen for everybody involved. Now, things do tend to get corrupted at some point if you go too far one way or the other. You know, just take, for example, Blue Oval City. That would have never happened. This is the new Ford truck plant. The electric truck called the Lightning is going to be built in Stanton, Tennessee, which is just a little nothing. I don't even know if they have a traffic light in Stanton. But they're going to have a multi-billion dollar investment, a new Ford plant. And that could not have happened had not government gotten involved and greased the skids, so to speak. I think 15 different states were going after that Ford operation. And Tennessee won. I guess we bribed enough people. No, that's not true. They did it the right way. But recently, I think 2 days ago, Mary Barra, who is the CEO of General Motors, Elon Musk, who is the CEO and primary owner of Tesla, Jim Farley, who is the CEO of Ford Motor Company, and a few other industry leaders met with the Biden administration on EV policy, electric vehicle policy. I think there was a guy there from Chrysler as well. But they are going to work together over the next few years to do several things. Number one, EV chargers need to be universal. In other words, they need to work with any electric vehicle. Now, right now, Tesla has their own superchargers, but that's not fair. Well, I guess it is, you know, from the standpoint of they were trying to establish themselves as the, and I guess, and they succeeded as the only choice for real long-range electric vehicles. And so they set up charging stations everywhere. He knew. Elon Musk is a smart guy, very smart. Matter of fact, I think he's the richest man in the world now. He took over Jeff Bezos's position, who is the CEO of Amazon. But he recognized that if people can't find a place to charge their Tesla, then they won't buy them. So he has a very extensive network of chargers, but they only work on Teslas. They don't work on your Mach-E Mustang or your new Volkswagen, whatever it's called, electric vehicle. And they won't work on a lot of the new ones that are coming out. But so he agreed. He says, yeah, they need to be universal. And so they're going to create a national network as a result of this meeting, supposedly, of 500,000 chargers. Does that sound like enough? I don't know if it's enough, but they just throw out these numbers all the time anyway. They also agreed to the tougher EPA guidelines for emissions. Now, would you think that automakers would agree to tougher guidelines for emissions? Well, if they want to get along with government, they will. And they did. And, you know, the car makers are so good right now. The engineering is so refined and so effective as far as squeezing out hydrocarbons and all the bad stuff. Nitrous oxide, is that one of them? I can't remember. But stuff that comes out of the tailpipe, they're pretty good at making that, at minimizing that. But it's not good enough for the environmentalists. They want it all gone. They don't want you driving an internal combustion or a car or an SUV or a truck with an internal combustion engine. You shouldn't have the right to do that because you are destroying the planet. That's what they say anyway. So another group that's really concerned about this big push to EVs, though, that the, I guess, all the politicians are beholden to are farmers. Yes, why would farmers be upset about the push to electric vehicles? Da, 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 da. That's right. Farmers grow corn. And what is corn used for? Corn is used for ethanol. Did you know that 36% of the United States corn crop goes to manufacture ethanol? 36%. So if everybody all of a sudden starts driving electric vehicles, what happens to the price of corn? It goes way down. And other related crops suffer as well. You know, farmers have to make money too. Of course, a lot of them are corporate farmers now. I think the days of the family farm are limited. You know, what a great place to raise kids and to have a life, you know, out in the green pastures and all that stuff. But, you know, it's become a huge business, and the biggest farmers are actually corporate farmers, and they're the ones that are screaming. They actually got lobbyists out there with the oil companies have finally stopped fighting the ethanol folks, and they're joining together to fight against EVs and EV acceptance. Good luck with that. But anyway, we'll see what happens. I'm going to take my first break, and I'll be back here in just a minute. I'm going to tell you how car dealers count profit on a car deal. And maybe some car dealers won't like me telling you this, but I'm going to anyway. Here we go. Okay, so here's a car dealer, me, telling you how dealers count profit on a car deal. Now, I'm a little bit different from a reporter that reports on the auto industry or a government official who is throwing rocks at the auto industry for, you know, taking advantage of people. I'm actually a car dealer and have been one for 44 years now. It's in my blood, but, you know, I do like passing on information. I see this as human service, being able to help people learn about something that can help them. And it really doesn't hurt me. I mean, you know, I think one of the biggest problems has been that car dealers in general have tried to make the public think that they're not making anything. And, you know, the public understands, for the most part, the need for a business to make a profit. They don't have a problem with the profit. They just have a problem with the lying. And so, you know, my general rule is never lie. Always be truthful and honest, and it will come back to you in a positive way. So let's talk about how dealers count profit on a car. If you're looking at a new car on a dealer's lot, he got that car one of two ways. He ordered it from the factory, they shipped it and billed him for it, or he picked it up from another dealer selling the same brand. That is called a dealer trade. What a complicated name. When he is billed for the car from the factory, however, the price he pays is called the invoice price. Ever heard that number or that name? Of course you have. Now, this is where it gets a little complicated. The invoice price is not the actual cost for two reasons. Number one, he also gets a refund of up to 3% from the manufacturer after a certain period of time elapses. That amount reduces his actual cost from the invoice price that he paid to what he has after he gets that 3% holdback. Yep, that's what it's called. You may have heard that term as well. Well, the holdback thing, I don't even understand exactly why that started. It goes back to the 50s. It was supposedly an encouragement to dealers to stock more cars, help them with their cash flow, and allow them to discount cars that they had had on the lot for a little while. Now we pretty much get hold back within a week of when the cars come in. So it really doesn't do any of that stuff. But anyway, it's called holdback. Now, the dealer also receives some money back from the manufacturer to assist in advertising and the floor plan interest carrying charges that we have on inventory. You can imagine if I have $5 million worth of cars out here, and then I have to borrow the money from like Ford Motor Credit or Nissan Credit and pay interest on that while the car is sitting here. When I sell the car, I pay it off. So it's just like you do when you buy a car and finally make the monthly payments and pay the bank, then they send you the title. The same thing works for a car dealer. So this advertising and floor plan interest credit totals about another 3%. So in theory, a dealer can sell a car for his original cost and still make a little money with this money coming back to him. Now, number two, another reason the invoice price is not a dealer's actual cost is because what a dealer pays for a car does not reflect his actual cost to sell the car. You can imagine there are expenses involved in running a business, things like variable overhead expenses, including, you know, sales compensation, vehicle preparation expenses. Lots of other overhead costs factor in before the dealer really makes any money on a car. It all depends on how you handle the accounting of it. You know, currently, cars are selling at MSRP or higher, so profitability on each individual car is higher now, but the lack of overall volume due to the chip shortages is offsetting the bigger margins. Now, most car buyers have trade-ins, and this is where most new car dealers have to make the most profit due to the low gross margins that are typical of the new car business. Let's say that you have a 2015 F-150 you're trading in on a new F-150. And that trade-in cash value, or the real wholesale value as determined by the dealer and, you know, what's going on in the market, is $25,000. So a 2015 F-150 is worth $25,000 on the wholesale market. Dealers refer to that as the actual cash value. You may hear a salesperson say, well, the ACV on your car is... Well, what he's talking about, and he's probably not leveling with you, is that the actual cash value of the car to the dealership, if they were just buying it off the street, would be $25,000. Now, if the dealer trades with you, that ACV will become his cost basis on his books for your traded F-150. So let's also say that you have agreed to a price of, let's say, $60,000 on the brand new F-150 you're looking at. Now, based on that sale price, let's assume that the dealer is actually making about a 2% margin or about $1,200 gross profit. Now, this is where the dealer can make additional money. Instead of offering you $25,000 for your truck, which he has determined is the actual cash value of your truck to him, he offers you less. Let's say $22,000. And let's say you accept that offer. He didn't say anything about the $25,000. He just offers you $22,000. Then he is able to book the value of the trade as $25,000 on his books and show an additional profit of $3,000 because he paid you $3,000 less for your vehicle than he is willing to put it on the books for. Now, you're thinking, no, wait a minute. That's not right. Is this illegal or unethical? Well, when you think about it, the answer is no. Let's give you an example that unrelated to cars. If you were able to buy a house for $10,000, less than you thought it was worth, and was willing to pay if you had to, is that illegal or unethical? No. That's what they call negotiation and understanding market values. I mean, if a man buys my house, then turns around the next day and sells it for a huge profit, was that wrong? No. That's how he makes a living, flipping houses for less than he paid for them. And that's exactly what car dealers do. Now, if you do more research and have a real good idea what the actual cash value of your car is, then you are liable to pay less. But if you have no clue what your trade-in is worth, I think you see how you could end up paying more than you would otherwise if you knew what the true value of your car was. You know, people sometimes erroneously base the value of their car on what their payoff is. Folks, your payoff, what you owe the bank for your car, has nothing to do with the value of your car. Your car may be worth a lot more than the payoff or a lot less. You know, if it's worth more, then you have equity. If it's worth less, we call that being upside down or negative equity. So dealers count profit on a car by the amount over their cost that they sold the car for, plus any extra profit that they picked up on the trade offer versus the actual cash value. So your job as a consumer is to minimize both of those numbers. Right now, you don't have a lot of power on the front end of the car that you're buying, the purchase car, because, you know, prices are so high and there's more buyers out there than there are cars. The law of supply and demand is kicking in. I learned that in first quarter economics at the University of Tennessee. But you do have power on your trade value, but only if you know what that value is. So where do you get those values? Well, I'm going to tell you. You know, you can drive your car around and get cash offers from other dealers. Right now, it's a great way to determine the value of your car is just to go to, you know, ABC Chevrolet and say, I want to speak to the used car manager. I'm interested in possibly selling my car, and I want to know what they would pay me for it. And they'll come out. They're needing to buy cars anyway. They'll come out and make you an offer and say, well, I want to think about it. You know, just like you do at the clothing store when somebody walks up to you and says, can I help you? And you say, no, I'm just thinking about it. I'm just looking around. You can also get a bid from Carvana. You can go online if you know how to do that. CarMax will probably, I don't know, I think they have an online resource also, but they probably need to lay their eyes on the car. You can also look at advertised sale prices of cars like yours on sites like CarGurus or AutoTrader. But just keep in mind, the cars that you're seeing advertised online, those have profit built into them. So you need to, you know, probably subtract, 6 to 10%, maybe not that much, off of what you're seeing them advertised for. Sometimes they're right on the money of what you could get for your car. Dealers will cut the prices to the bone when a car's been sitting on their lot for about 90 days, and they'll do that online as well. You know, no single source is going to give you the info that you need, however. But if you arm yourself with the results from several sources, just write them down or print them out, then at least you have an idea and you're negotiating from a stronger position. You know, if they make you some really low offer, just take the paper and show it to them. Say, well, this is what I found when I was online about the value of my car. And just see what they say. You know, if they get real smart alecky or they say, well, that you can't trust that stuff that you see online. Say, what about your prices? You put them online, don't you? Can you not trust that either? You know, there's lots of different things you can do, but just being armed with the information to defend yourself is the best way to go. Okay, I'm going to take my last break. I know you're tired, and I'll be back here in just a second. Okay, I'm back. You know, I've been kind of watching Bring a Trailer on these 1968 through early 70s Honda CT70. It's called a Trail 70. And I had a couple of these when I was younger. It's a kind of a pressed frame. It doesn't have a gas tank. It's a motorcycle. Did I say that? And it's very small, has a banana seat and high-rise handlebars. And it just got me thinking about how did that happen? How did that come about? You remember growing up in the 60s how banana seats and monkey handlebars came out? Maybe it was a result of choppers and motorcycles, but according to the experts and the people who look into this stuff, a guy named Al Fritz, who worked for Schwinn, was the pioneer of the Stingray bicycle. I actually have one. I'm looking at it right now. I'm in my office, and right there is my 1968 Schwinn Apple Crate with the banana seat and high-rise handlebars and the five-speed gear shifter on the just on the frame below the seat or between the seat and handlebars. They had to quit doing that because little boys were jumping forward and doing damage. You can imagine where. But anyway, these, he called them butterfly-style handlebars. I just called them monkey bars, and banana seats and chrome fender-covered nylon wheels. They were introduced by Schwinn and called the Stingray when it was first introduced in 1963. You know, there was another Stingray that was introduced in 1963, and it had a split rear window and was made by Chevrolet. But yeah, these bikes were the brainchild of a Schwinn executive engineer. His name was Al Fritz, and he was sparked. His creativity was sparked, according to this article, after being tipped off to a new trend that saw innovative kids in where? California, retrofitting their Schwinns to make them look more like what? Motorcycles. That's right. So during his tenure there at Schwinn, the first 5 years on the market, the Stingray sold for about $49.95. They went on to move close to 2 million of these bicycles. And then in 1968, they came out with the Krate bikes, K-R-A-T-E. Which is what mine is. They hit the market in 68, which is when I got my bike at the Norris Bicycle Shop in St. Albans, West Virginia. One of the happiest days of my life. But anyway, it was I never wrecked this bike. It was kind of guarded and protected. When I wanted to ride rough, I'd get my homemade Stingray bike. We all had those. And then I would get my Mickey Mantle, my priceless Mickey Mantle baseball and Roger Maris baseball cards and get one of my mom's clothing line clips and clip them on my drop bar so they'd go in my spokes and go prrrr. That was kind of hard to describe, but that's exactly what I used to do. And I'd like to have all of those wonderful, valuable baseball cards that I destroyed with my bicycle. But wouldn't we all rather love to have something that we destroyed, like Matchbox cars and Tonka toys and Superman magazines and so forth? Well, since I've got you depressed, I might as well say goodbye. Thanks for listening to this edition of My Car Guru, and I guess I'll see you Monday morning. Bye-bye.